I want to read to you, there's two books that I'd like to recommend on this particular subject, and I think this is a very important subject, therefore I think these are very important books. David Platt wrote a book called Follow Me. It's a couple hundred page paperback. It's a good book that looks at the will of God in a more in-depth way than we'll be able to do in one Sunday school class. But it's a good book. It's worth reading. It'll help you with decision-making and understanding the will of God. Just Do Something is one of the five best books I've ever read. Just bar none, one of the five best books I've ever read. It is specifically intended for young Christians, people in their 20s, and even more specifically for young Christian men who seem to suffer this kind of decision paralysis where they can't make decisions because they're so busy looking for the will of God they can never actually do anything. And so the book is trying to correct that problem. Just do something, and then obviously there's a framework within the, well, what is the something that's okay to do? I still find it helpful to reread this book now. I just think it is a really, really helpful book. It is tiny. I mean, it is an easy read. Kevin is a great writer, great guy. If you haven't read the book, you should read it. Pretty much no matter where you are in life, if you haven't read the book, you should read it. It's a couple of afternoon commitment at most to get it read, and it will really defend the arguments that I'm going to make this morning with regards to the will of God. So, highly recommend that book. The foreword to that book, I want to read you a paragraph from that. Kevin didn't write it. A guy named Josh wrote it, but I want to read it to you because I think it'll kind of warm up the room a little bit for the kind of discussion we're going to have today, which could be one with a little bit of disagreement, but let's at least have some fun with it. So here's how the book, it's the foreword to the book. But here's the first thing you read when you open that book. It is God's will for you to read this book. Yes, I'm talking to you. What are the odds that you would just happen to pick up this book and flip open to this page and start reading? Obviously, it's a sign. Of the millions of books in the world, you found this one. Wow, I have chills. Do not pass up this divinely orchestrated moment. If you miss this moment, there's a good chance you will completely miss God's will for the rest of your life and spend your days in misery and regret. And then the next paragraph says, everything I've just said in that previous paragraph is complete nonsense. But it is an interesting challenge to the way that we tend to think about God's will, which is that there is a will of God for our life. God loves us and has a wonderful plan for us. Well, that part is true. But because God has this wonderful plan for us, it is my job in every moment to figure out what every aspect of that plan is. And if I find it and I do it, I will be blessed. And if I don't find it or I don't do it, I will have bad news. That's the way most people think about God's will. I don't want to do something that's outside of God's will, so I got to figure out what God's will is so that then I can do it. And it's one thing to say that about whether or not you should murder your grandmother and take her insurance money, right? God's will is pretty clear, pretty clearly laid out on that issue. But it's another when you're trying to decide, do I move to Atlanta or do I move to Los Angeles? If God has one perfect will for you, then one of those answers is right, and one of them's wrong, and one of them's going to bring blessing, and one of them's going to bring curse. And it's that simple. And that's the way a lot of Christians go through life. So I wanted to revisit the discussion about what is God's will, particularly as we think about decision-making and how we know what God's will is as we try to make decisions. We talked last semester about God's will, and we really focused on two different ways of talking about God's will. The first is the will of decree. This is what actually happens. And if you struggle with this, as we all do at some level, but some more than others, you just have to go back to the doctrine of God's sovereignty, and you have to read what Scripture says about God being sovereign. if it is true that there is not a sparrow that could fall from the sky that God did not decree, if God is sovereign over every piece of minute detail within his world, if that is true, then everything that actually happens is God's will in that sense. And we really struggle with that because there are some obvious challenges in our minds. One is, well, then what does that mean for human free will? If God's decreed everything that's going to happen, then I'm just a robot and a puppet. And what you have to do is, again, go back to the Bible where the Bible says, no, that's absolutely not true. You do what you want to do. But where God's sovereignty takes in is your wants. And so it is true that he has foreordained whatsoever shall come to pass. And that's one of the doctrines that we affirm. So everything that actually happens is the will of God when we're talking about his will of decree. And you say, well, how could that be? Because there's really, really terrible things that happen. And how could those be inside the will of God? So again, we go back to the Bible, and what do we see? We go to the worst event in the history of the world, the biggest injustice, the most corrupt sequence of events, the worst atrocity in the history of God's creation is when Jesus Christ, the sinless one, was tried and found guilty and was crucified. That is the biggest atrocity in the history of the world. Did God decree that event? All those events? Is that part of his will? Absolutely. We don't struggle with that. But we struggle with it when we look at things that are bad that don't have to do with Jesus. And then we say, well, no, God wouldn't have decreed that. He can't possibly have wanted that to occur. Well, in this sense of want, of will, absolutely. So every single thing that happens is part of God's will of decree. That's what it means for him to be sovereign. There is nothing that happens that is outside of his control. Nothing. We may not like it. But that was last semester, was whether or not we like it. This semester is, this is what we've agreed on, so now let's make some decisions. So, how can you know with certainty whether or not something is in God's will of decree? It happens. That's how you can know God's will with certainty when you're talking about this type of will. So can you know God's will of decree with certainty before it happens? It's a trick question. No, except for things that God has promised will happen. Because if he has said it, you can be as certain as if it will actually happen. So when God says Jesus will return, we can be as certain that that is God's will because God doesn't lie and there's no shadow of turning within him. He doesn't change. We can be as certain when God says it as if it had already happened. But for everything else, let's drop the eschatological prophetic promises for a minute. Let's just set those aside. For everything else, you cannot know it is God's will until it happens. And then the moment it happens, you know it was God's will. So how useful is it to say that you're going to make decisions on the basis of figuring out this? Not very. Is it God's will that I would drop the black marker or the blue marker? You don't know. Now you do. Yay, we found God's will, right? So with the decisions that we make in life, when we're trying to find this type of will, the will of decree, this is a fool's errand to think that any amount of data, any amount of research, any amount of effort is going to let you figure out what this is. Unless God has specifically said, I am going to do this, you don't know. Yeah. He said, sometimes we feel as though God is leading us. And we talked about that last week, and we'll talk about that more in just a little bit when we get to will of direction. All right, let's talk about will of desire. This is one we talked about last semester too. What this means is, we really struggle with this one because in one sense it means what God wants in his nature. And you say, well, if God wants something, he can get it. So what do you mean wants in his nature? But the way we can best understand this is through God's law. God's will of desire is like when the New Testament says that God desires that none should perish, that God desires that all men should be holy, that in his nature, in his character, which is perfection, which is holiness, if his nature and his character were the only factor in what were going to happen, that's what would happen. Perfection all the time. That's God's will of desire. We know through the other things that Bible teaches us that it's not just God's character that is involved in what God decrees to actually happen. It's also his glory. And so there are things that his character would not want, sin, that for the sake of his own glory, he decrees. So a world where there is no fall better reflects the nature of God than a world where there is a fall, right? Only if you're talking about holiness. All by itself is part of his nature. Because a world where there is no fall does not reflect grace or forgiveness or long-suffering or patience, or go down the list of attributes that would not be displayed, attributes in which God would not be glorified if there was no fall. So in some eternal, cosmic, divine calculation, God orchestrates a universe where all of his attributes are maximally glorified. And that is the universe that we have. So when we look at the universe and we say, if his holiness were maximally glorified at the expense of everything else, everything would be perfect. No sin, no fall, no corruption, no curse, no sickness, no death, none of it. But actually, as the Bible teaches, that would give us a deficient view of God. You would have seen God's power in creation, which is magnificent, but you would have never seen God's power in redemption, which is unbelievable. The God can conquer death. Didn't see that one coming, did you? Right? So this world that actually occurs is different from his will of desire, because that will of desire is really what would God's world be if he did not need to be glorified in all of his attributes. Does that make sense? So this is really about moral perfection. God's desire is moral perfection. It's no death, it's no sin, it's no suffering, it's no sorrow. In terms of his own character, his nature, that's the desire. What is actually decreed, what happens in this world, is more complicated than that for the sake of his own glory. And we can say, after the fall, for the sake of his own people. Because the will of desire, do you know what that does to Adam and Eve when they disobey and they fall? It kills them in a way they don't come back. We're done. What does the will of desire do in the age of Noah? Doesn't build a boat. Noah was good. He wasn't that good. What does it do? I mean, God looks on the earth and it says that all of the thoughts of all the men were only evil continually. Well, that's a good crowd. Let's spare a few of them. All right? So the will of desire is no good for us post-fall. All right? How important is God's will of desire in our decision-making, and how can we find it? Where would we unlock this mystery? Okay, the will of desire.
At the same time, there was a rebellion in heaven.
Yeah, in heaven now, not in heaven then. Yeah. His word. right? Where does God tell us how things ought to be? That might be a helpful way for you to think about this. How ought things to be, and how are things? Do you get that distinction? This is also what it will be like in the new heavens and the new earth. To go back to that phrase in the Lord's Prayer, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, is a prayer that the moral perfection that exists within the courts of God in heaven are the moral perfection that will exist in the courts of God and the new earth after the recreation of all things, and it ought to be the moral perfection that exists on the earth now, insofar as we are able to do that. So you want to know God's will of desire, you go to the Bible. How important is that for making decisions? Right now, we've said, I need to know what is the will of God. How can I do the things that I am supposed to do? How important is this category for making those types of decisions? Very. Very, 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 very important. This is where it all begins. Because if God says, I ought not do it, then the decision is made. I'm not going to do that. If God says, I must do something, then the decision is made. I have to do that. He doesn't always say that about every issue and every decision we're going to make. But boy, is that the place where we got to start. Right. Yeah. So the question was about kind of the power of positive thinking folks or the prosperity gospel folks, the name it and claim it idea, having some confusion here. And that's absolutely true, because it's easy to read the Bible at a superficial level to see texts that say, when you do good, you will be blessed, and think, well, that is an absolute now. And the best thing that could ever happen to someone who comes out of that tradition, which, by the way, I come out of that tradition, the best thing that can ever happen is that you would read Ecclesiastes and read the Psalms. Read the wisdom literature that the people of God have written, the very people who had these promises that say, you will be blessed. And then they wander in the desert. How do we connect this? And then they realize, wait, our disobedience and the sinfulness of the earth has a temporal and temporary effect on these promises. Because we live in a cursed world, because we live in a fallen and broken world, things that should result in good and will one day, now might not. So you would love to commend the person who makes a decision based entirely on what God's word tells them to do. That is a great decision. You made exactly the decision that God told you to make, and you would love to be able to say to them, therefore, nothing bad is going to happen. But you can't say that last part anymore, right? You end up being like Job's friends. Oh, you got problems in your life? Well, you obviously did something wrong. Because if you weren't doing something wrong, nothing bad would happen in your life. And the Bible just outright rejects that. Just categorically, that's not the world in which we live right now. We can be affected by other people's sin. We can be affected by our own sin that we're blinded to or that we're covering up. But we can just be affected by the fact that we live in a world that is cursed. You could live in Los Angeles and you can be a prayerful, God-fearing, gospel-believing person, and you can go to church and you can be faithful and you can love your neighbor and you can tithe and you can do all these wonderful things, and when the earthquake hits Los Angeles, your house can still get tore up. That's the reality of the world in which we live. And when you try to say that because of this, every outcome of every righteous action is only good, you're reading the Bible very selectively. You need to go read Ecclesiastes. Because the author of Ecclesiastes thinks that way at the beginning, either on purpose or for literary value. But he thinks that way at the beginning, and he goes nuts. That's actually what happens in Ecclesiastes. starts out with, you know, hey, this is the way that the world is. Do good, get good. Do bad, get bad. Except I look around me and I don't see any of that. Vanity of vanity. It's all meaningless. Everybody pack up and go home. That's what happens in Ecclesiastes. It's a direct help for those of us who would be inclined to confuse those things. So that's a really good point. Jake?
You may get into this later, so push it off, but what does it mean to be blessed? Because a lot of people you talk to tend to equate that with material things.
Wow.
Especially for a Christian, if your money is an idol in your life and weakening your walk with God, and he takes it away, most people say, well, you're cursed, you're judged, but if it breaks that reliance on your money, blessing, even though it appears in
you know, in law school, we call that ask and answer. You answer the question that you ask. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I will punt on that for later, but just, you're exactly right. We have to be very careful. It's like in Romans 8:28, right? When God says that all these things work for good, the only way that verse is true is when God defines good. You have to read very carefully, contextually, what does God mean when he instructs Paul to say that? Because when I say all things work for good, what I mean is all things work for Paul's personal convenience. Like if I got to orchestrate the world and say that everything that God does in the world is for my good, it would involve my personal convenience. I would work less, and by less I mean none, right? My kids would obey. All these things would just be great because my life would be more convenient. Now, that's ridiculous. We know that's not what God means. But sometimes our definitions of good that creep into that verse aren't far from ridiculous either. So what it means to be blessed, what it means for God to do good, those are really good questions that we'll answer later. All right. The way I handle that situation, because you run into that all the time, is carefully. But I'll take issue to one caveat you made on the end. It is about rebellion. Okay. It is. And what was asked is, what do you do when you're dealing with a person who says, you know, look, I know what I ought to do and what God says, but if God's will of decree is so absolute anyway, then I can just do what I want to do and know that it was the will of God, and that's fine. I don't have to get caught up in always doing what the moral law says, because if I were to break the moral law, then obviously that's what God wanted in his decree anyway. And the idea was, and I fully get it, that a lot of times when people make that argument, they make it as if it's not an argument for rebellion. It's an intellectual argument. It's not a rebellious heart. I'm not upset about it. I'm not angry. I'm just telling you that consistent with your own logic, if this is the way the world works, that God's will is whatever comes to pass, then you really can do whatever you want, and that will be whatever comes to pass. That's just logic. That just makes sense. It's a rebellious heart. It's an attempt to hide a rebellious heart in an intellectual argument, but it's a rebellious heart because the heart that is changed by God, well, let me back up because I got to put caveats. I'm not speaking about every single situation in your life. There are moments in every single one of our lives where we know exactly what God tells us to do and we decide we don't want to do it. We do that. We can be Christians and do that because we are Christians and we do that, okay? So what I'm talking about is not a single event in your life or a moment. I'm talking about what What is your life characterized by? How would you describe your Christian life on the whole? And when God converts someone, and when God works in their hearts, the way that we think starts to become less and less starting the discussion with how can I get what I want within the rules that God has set up? Less and less thinking like that, more and more thinking like what pleases God. And everybody that I know, and this is just pastoral experience and it's a pretty small sample size, and so I can completely be wrong, except I'm not. I can be wrong about how common it is. Everybody I know who makes these types of intellectual arguments, at the end of the day, it's a rebellious heart. And what they want is just to see how much of themselves they can keep and still get credit for loving God or for being a Christian or for obeying God. And anytime you have to get into a nuanced argument about moral behavior, you are down the wrong track. Anytime you're having to decide, is this the step too far, or is you're down the wrong track, because you started that decision with a way of thinking, how much can I get away with? How far can I go? This is the place where I am and where I want to be. How many steps do I have to take toward God for it to be enough? As opposed to starting every decision with, how do I please God? Forget about myself. How do I please God? And it is only regeneration that can make you think that way, because it is only regeneration that can ever give you the faith you need to trust God will take care of you better than you will take care of you. We come at decision making from a position of selfishness. All of us in the flesh come at it from selfishness, but we come at it for different reasons. We have very different motivations for thinking so selfishly. Some people think selfishly because they're overcome by greed and lack of contentment. I want more. I want better. I want more. I want better. God's not going to give me more and better. I got to take it for myself. Some people come at that position of selfishness because of fear. How can I trust somebody else to take care of me and to protect me the way I would take care of myself and protect myself? We come at selfishness for lots of different motivations, but at the end of the day, all of it is selfishness. And the only thing that can change that way of thinking is for the grace of God to come and to give us faith where all of a sudden we are able to say, I trust God. It is absolutely a trust, a faith issue. Do you believe that instead of having to look out for yourself, what can I get away with, how far can I go, how much do I have to give God, and how much can I hold back? Instead of approaching every decision that way, if I started it with, I want to please God, and I know that He will take care of me, the only way we could ever do that is by faith. So it is fundamentally a rebellion issue. Rebellion for different reasons. Not all rebellion is just shaking my angry fist, I don't like you. Sometimes it's fearful. Hey, I really like you, but I struggle to believe that you're actually going to provide for me here. Right? I really think you need my input, my creativity and decision making to protect my family from what's going to happen next. As opposed to trust. I trust God. Ooh, that's the hardest part of decision making, isn't it? Is the I trust God. Because we run in circles, this circle, with some really great people. Most of you, I mean, there's Morley, but most of you, I loved it. Most of you are really great people. And we'll look out for one another pretty well. But I can't fully trust you to look out for me and my family and take care. So even the people in this world that I can trust the most, I still have to hold something back. I can't trust you entirely. And that's kind of the way we approach God. God, we don't know anybody that we trust that much. And what you're asking us to do in the amount of trust and the way we're supposed to trust you is really foreign to us. And so we struggle with it.
Seems like each generation it's not a rebellion. Even the ones that want to remain faithful to God, it's a lack of trust that their parents or the previous generations have figured things out. And so they push those boundaries and want to go just as far as possible. They look at the emerging church movement or whatever.
Yeah, and the point was about the generational differences and similarities on this issue. And you're right. Every generation does this in their own way, and their own way is normally a reaction to the generation that came before them. So in this country, you look at the World War II generation, right? The greatest generation that ever lived, except when it comes to trusting God. Because the greatest generation that ever lived, which in the sense in which that phrase meant, I'm not disagreeing with at all. They were able, in their own eyes, many of them, to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps, to make it happen when nobody else could make it happen, to be the bravest and the best and the most industrious, and everybody goes off to war, and women and children who didn't have these responsibilities before now have to have them because there is no choice, and they got it done. But the phrase, got it done by God's grace, seems to have disappeared from the American lexicon. So all of a sudden, it's a generation of people who just by their own industriousness and ingenuity and smarts and strength and bravery and courage were able to be amazing. Well, who needs God if you're that good? And then look at their children, right? Many, many, many of them took that attitude. Who needs God? Church was a pro forma activity. You just go because it's still the culturally acceptable thing to do, and that's what you do on your weekends. But there's no personal relationship with God. There's no daily, deep dependence on God. So that's where the mainline liberal churches came from. People who go to church because it's a social activity, especially in the southeastern United States, it's just what you have to do. So that's where the mainline churches, and that's why they're dying. Because their children who grew up in that church environment say, this is dumb. If we don't believe any of this, if this has no actual value, I'm going to stay home, which is a totally logical decision. So then you have the generation that just stops going to church. But then they miss the community that church provided. They realize that we need one another. We need community. How could we find that community? Well, and then you get things like you mentioned with the emerging church or the house church movement, or that, look, we just need to be around people. Or even megachurches are actually that, because the megachurch model is you do not come together for community, you come together for social convention and tradition, but all the megachurches are huge on you got to have small groups, because that's where the real living happens. So then it's back to the sense of community. How do we find that? It's not that all of these things are bad, or that, some of those things are particularly bad, but it's not that they're all bad. It's that they are reactions to the generation that came before in the way that the generation before did not trust. And so however you don't trust, your kids will live out the logical ramifications of your lack of trust. Just know that. You will live with that logical inconsistency. You will say, yeah, I don't believe any of this stuff, but I go to church. I used to laugh. It's horrible. But how many people would say to me, we don't believe, we don't go to church, but we've started coming because we've got kids and we feel like it'll be good for the kids. What will be good for the kids? I don't understand. If you don't believe it, if it's not true, if you don't think it matters to you, why would you subject your children to this? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So you'll be logically inconsistent. You'll say, I don't believe it, but I go because I don't want to upset the boat and blah, blah, blah. Or, I don't think God's commands about tithing or being generous with our money matter. So, but people got to see you do such and such, so I'll blah, blah, blah. Your kids, they look through all that nonsense as nonsense. No. I'm not doing that. And then you get a generation who's reacted against your lack of trust. And then the pendulum swings back and it goes back and forth and back and forth. But everybody's problem is the same. They don't trust. They don't believe. Very long-winded answer to your question, but I think it's a really important issue. One of the things that you will identify week after week after week after week in this class, if you are anything like me, as we start to really work through some of these specific decisions, you're going to realize that it all hinges on trust. All of it. because of what I'm taking away from you this morning, which is this last type of will of direction. All right, we've talked about will of decree. We can't really look for that when we're trying to make decisions because you don't know it until it happens unless God has said it. Will of desire is extremely important, and it's extremely clear. God gives us his law. He gives us moral commands. And so we go into the Bible, and we understand what we absolutely ought to do and absolutely ought not to do. That is really, really helpful and really, really important. Except I make a whole lot of decisions in life that are not moral decisions. Am I moving to Atlanta? Am I moving to Los Angeles? Am I buying this house or that house? Am I going to work in this field or that field? Am I going to marry this person or that person? For those of you that had choices. That's an inside joke that sounds worse when you say it out loud. So what we look for is what we call the will of direction. And that's back to that idea that life is a journey, and in this journey, I'm going to call this the journey of Paul. God has mapped out a very specific will for my life that involves all of these decisions. Where I'm going to go to school, who I'm going to marry, all this stuff, how many kids I'm going to have. God's mapped it all out. There is a right answer to every one of those. And then my job as a Christian is to figure it out. And so as I make decisions, to try and keep my decisions as closely aligned to those decisions as possible. And if I can go through my whole life where when I make decisions, I have figured out the will of God and I do it, then I'm going to have a really, really great life. But if I come to the fork in the road about where am I going to go to college, and instead of discerning the will of God and going there, I make the wrong choice, my life deviates wildly from this wonderful plan that God had for me, and now the best I can do the rest of my life is, you know, that. This is what we look for. This is what we want. Got some bad news for you. That's actually really good news. This doesn't exist. It does not exist. The thing that many of us, think we are looking for the most in decision making does not exist. That's why I said, might get mad at me. And to just stick the knife in a little bit further, I'm going to read a quote I agree with from one of the books I recommended. Too many of us pass off our own instability, inconsistency, and endless self-exploration as looking for God's will, as if not making up our minds is a mark of spiritual sensitivity. We use it as an excuse. The reason I'm not making a decision, the reason that I am wringing my hands in, wait for it, anxiety, and baptizing my sinful anxiety as spiritual maturity is that I am looking for God's direction. I'm looking for his will. And that doesn't exist. That thing you're looking for, the signposts in the road that will help you make the perfect decision that sets up the rest of your life for more and more perfect decisions that God's going to love, does not exist. So then what are we doing this class for? How do you make decisions when you find out that that doesn't exist? That's what we're going to talk about. If I quit looking for this, how then am I going to make decisions, and what does that mean for the decisions that I make?
Don't you think what's really going on in the minds of lots of Christians is they get stuck in this idea that since God has a will decree, and when they look back and see it was one thing, they therefore think when they're looking forward to making a decision that there's only got to be one idea in God's mind that can actually happen. Whereas I think truly if you're doing the God, maybe it's God's will, you can go to Atlanta or to Boston.
That's right.
And people just go, oh my gosh, I can't see this.
God's will of decree is only going to be one of those, right?
Right.
But you can't know it until it happens. It's like finding your one true love. I love my wife. I wouldn't trade my wife for anyone. That is a historical point of view, though, right? I have been through significant portions of this realm of decision-making in my life with her and been blessed by the fact that she is there. So then I look back and I say, I made the right choice, which is a wonderful sweetheart thing to say, but it's also logically insane. Because what I don't know is if I had married any of five other people at this point, there would be different blessings, different advantages of being married to that person, different decisions and ways that things would be made, but they could be good too, right? Our sort of romantic selves don't like that very much. But whether I go to Atlanta or Los Angeles, I come to Atlanta, I get advantages A, B, C, and D, and they play out this way in my life. And I think, man, Atlanta was a great choice. I move to Atlanta. I sit on Georgia 400 North for 3 hours trying to get home at 7 o'clock at night. And I think Atlanta was not a good choice. Blessings and curses that came with my decision. And this goes back to Jake's question a little bit. What you have to be really careful of is that you don't think you're competent to put all of those blessings and I'm not going to try to draw that. That'd be a disaster. To try and put all of those blessings and curses on a scale and then judge whether your decision was good or bad based on how things pan out. Because if you make a decision and 99% of the things as a result of that decision go wrong, but the one that goes right is that it was faithful to God's word, you win. It was good. Oh, I don't want to. Yeah.
I don't find all that. There's five other possibilities romantic at all. Who cares?
That's right. Yeah, I agree. So this concept of will of direction, this one, I work in IT, and one of the projects we're working on right now for a company is, you know, all their servers that they run their business on have to have software installed. And we're trying to create the one master image of software that goes on all their computers that we know is completely secure and completely patched and works with everything they have. And that's called the gold image. And every time they set up a new computer, they have to use this gold image. And nothing can deviate from it because we know that it's perfect. And so many Christians think that there is a gold image of their life. That if I could just make these decisions, as long as I'm always in line with God's will, and then you wonder what? Because they're too smart to say nothing bad will ever happen, because we go back to the Ecclesiastes problem, right? You can make all these so-called perfect decisions, but according to the Bible, you live in a fallen and broken world, and a bunch of bad stuff's going to happen too, even if you make them. This view also, so this view is bad, it's wrong, this doesn't exist, for all of the reasons that I've mentioned, but there's another one, which is that this paints a really dim view of God's grace for when you make bad decisions. Anybody in here ever made a bad decision, one that you'd look back on that you'd say, yeah, it wasn't the right choice? Does God say, well, sorry, now you're down here on plan B. Hope you don't mess up anymore because plan C is a doozy. Or is there grace for the bad decisions? And dare I say, even God bringing about good from the bad decisions? You know, dropping my brother into a pit and selling him into slavery in Egypt? Not my finest moment. And yet, what can God do? So it's not just God makes lemons out of lemonade. It's that God, in his perfect will of decree, actually, Romans 8:28, brings about actual blessing, actual good, which we can further define later. He brings those about on the basis of all kinds of things, including decisions where you picked one out of 50 lawful options and it was fine, or decisions where you picked the unlawful option and actually did what you weren't supposed to do. And God still brings about good and his own glory with it. This is the mentality we have to get into if we're going to make decisions. Because if you go into a specific decision-making process believing that among the lawful options, we'll talk about that later, but among the lawful options, one of them is right and all the rest of them will screw up your life, you will be paralyzed. You will never make decisions. How could you? And then how quickly will you bail on the decisions that you do make when the outcome doesn't look perfect immediately? Oh, that must have been the wrong one. God hates me. Ah, better switch. Right? How there are so many things that God allows us to decide for ourselves, which He has decreed, but He gives us wants. He gives us responsibility. And so we get this experience of making decisions that matter. So many of them have multiple lawful options. How do I decide? It can't be this. It can't be this idea that one of them's right and all the rest of them are wrong and that's just the end of your life. We recently, 2 years ago, boy, time flies, a few years ago, had to decide a whole bunch of things at once in our life that seemed like these monumental decisions. Are we going to have a third child or stop with two? Am I going to stay in ministry? Are we going to continue to live in Winston-Salem? If we move, where are we going to move? If I change jobs, what kind of work am I going to do? If we live near family, which family? Well, that was easy because mine are nuts. How do you make all of these decisions? Well, if I had sat around making flow charts of all the possible outcomes from all of these decisions that I could have made, first of all, how dumb and inaccurate would those have been, as if I possibly know what the outcome of some of these decisions are? And then two, how could I have ever decided? Well, this is good here, but then this is bad, and this is really good. Oh, this is really bad. How would you ever decide anything? And so, back to Kevin DeYoung's title, that's what actually happens, is that good, thoughtful Christian people who are trying to make good decisions and obey God's will never decide to do anything because they are stuck, afraid that they'll pick wrongly. This also allows us to make excuses about the future. Well, the reason that my life is where it is now is because I married the wrong person. The reason that my life is the way it is now is because I took the wrong job. I got the wrong major. I bought the wrong car. So, God's not calling you to relive that decision. God's calling you to make decisions now in light of where you are now. You're not on the plan B track where now you have to make all of these adjustments because you've so defied God's will, things will never be good again. You're just here. So what's next? Watch the unfolding of God's will of decree as you become more and more obedient to His will of desire, sanctification. That's what's next. If that was an ungodly decision, then you know what you ought to do? Make more godly decisions. If it was a godly decision or a perfectly lawful decision that just had a bad outcome, I'm sorry. I'm extremely compassionate with that. And that's one of the places where Christians are called to be compassionate with one another. Because there's a whole bunch of stuff in this life that you just can't control. But trust God. Right? That's what it comes back down to, is trust God.
We're talking purely on a personal level here, but for those like me who are like political junkies or people that think more on a national or way, this is very helpful because God's will of desire for a nation like our country is that we would glorify Him and have everything would be great morally. And to see the decline of our nation in our own minds,
right,
we see as a decline, could drive us crazy if we didn't understand.
We're doomed. The destruction of the empire is upon us.
I mean, to
maybe.
Back in to say, this is God's will.
Yeah.
What has happened in the past,
that's right.
It is God's will.
Yeah.
And we don't know where it's going, but we trust Him.
Yep.
So it has a lot of far-reaching.
And whether you were devastated by the election of President Obama or devastated by the election of President George W. Bush, or both. They were both the will of God. Like, that's the way you look at this. That's the will of God. And so how do I live faithfully in this world that God is unfolding? Well, trust God, because maybe it's the resurgence of our nation, or maybe it's its death. I don't know. But God calls me to be faithful in my decision making, and not to trust in the government, not to trust in these human forces, but to trust in God.
It's worth noting, so say, you know, without making any judgment, say we have a nation or something in the past that happened, like the election of the president, and say that was morally a wrong decision, right? Even if it happened and you voted against it, say, there is a right or wrong decision, even if it happened. Does that make sense?
I wish you'd picked a different example, though. Yeah, because I'm not willing to say that voting for the president or not voting was morally wrong.
Joseph.
Yes, they shouldn't have thrown him in the pit.
Right,
right. So just because something happens here in the will of decree does not suddenly baptize it here. That's exactly right. And that goes back to God, for the purpose of his own glory, bringing about things that are not righteous. That he decrees that in our choices, our sins, which are still sins and we're responsible for them, fit into this. Yeah, and you do have to be careful you don't do the baptizing.
Otherwise, what happens is you either neglect your responsibility back then, thinking there is no right decision because it was will of God that this happened.
That's right. So then it becomes a cop out. You use it, which goes back to your point earlier.
You know, why don't we sin more?
Yeah, hey, we should just sin more and then God would have more grace, right? Yeah.
At the end of the day, everything right that God decreed from before time began would happen
anyway.
But
y'all remember Kevin DeYoung makes the point, just do something. When I was a kid, those choose your own adventure books were really popular. You know? And little boys especially love those things because you kind of get to write your own story and you're climbing up the mountain and then you get the choice of, well, you hear a rumbling. Are you going to hide in this mountain cave or are you going to flee to the village and turn to page 33 and you turn out you hid in the mountain cave and, oh, that was a volcano, you're dead. You know? That's this. That's this. Oops, you made the choice that got you on page 33, you're dead now. You should choose differently. That's this will of direction. Oh, I'm so afraid. What if it's a... This is not how God calls us to live. God calls us to live trusting him. So we start here with the black and white. What's lawful and what's unlawful? What's obedient and what's disobedient? And that informs our choices. But then among the lawful choices, we just make them. And a huge part of making them, to the point that was raised earlier, was... what do I want? Which is another way of saying, and this is the controversial part, how do I feel God leading me? Like, how do I feel God leading me is another way of saying, what do I want? People do what they want to do. And we may have to go over that again because you'll do, oh, I didn't want it such and such, but yes, you did. Yes, you did. When I was a kid, my dad was a medical student and my mom was working as a nurse. And money was tight, and we had one car and a motorcycle, because my dad rode a motorcycle. And the car that my mom drove to work just died and wasn't going to be fixed and just wasn't going to work anymore. Apparently, that wasn't an option. I was a little kid. And my dad sold his motorcycle to buy a car for her so that she would have a reliable car. And my dad... we lived in Augusta at the time, and in God's providence, you could actually ride a bike from where we lived to school, and so that's what he did, and he rode a bike to school every day. A bicycle bike, not a motorcycle bike. Did my dad want to sell his motorcycle? No, he loved that motorcycle. He'd have done anything to keep that motorcycle. He hated giving up that motorcycle. All those things are true, except, yes, he did want to sell the motorcycle, because if he didn't want to sell the motorcycle, he wouldn't have done it. We do what we want to do. We don't always do what we think would be the most fun or what we like to do the most, but we do what we want to do. Every single decision we make is what we want to do. Guy had a gun to my head and said, type in your ATM code. I didn't want to type in my ATM code. Yes, you did, because you didn't want to die. Like, you did what you wanted to do. So when we say, I think God is leading me to do X, Y, Z, what you're really talking about is your wants, and that's okay. Please do not think I am criticizing that. I am trying to tell you that that's okay. You make your list of what's lawful and what's not. And now that we're dealing with the lawful list, we get into wisdom, these pros and these cons, these advantages, these disadvantages. The way I feel God leading me is just another way of describing God is making me like these advantages more than those disadvantages, or making me weigh these pros more than those cons. That's what that means. And that, not just is that okay, that's how it's supposed to be. And that's what we're going to do all semester. But this concept of God leading does not mean he's putting directional signs along this way so that you don't stray from the path. There are no directional signs here. This is a historical novel. You read this backwards after it happens. You don't read this looking forward. The only one you can read looking forward is this one. And so then you look for wisdom, and then your wants. I didn't get what I wanted. I wanted to buy this, but I bought this for my family instead. Good for you. You had good wants, and you acted on them. But don't tell me it's not what you wanted. You wrote the check. You swiped the card. Right, and when
because what happens is you could be audacious enough to say, well, I cheated on my wife to marry this woman because God told me.
And God bless that. Even if you take it away from that, people do this all the time, and I think in both books they raise this, where young men, dating young men and women, one of them will say to another, I just don't think that God told me we don't need to be together. Or I've heard the other, God told me this is the one I'm going to marry. Ooh, you be careful with that one, because if God didn't tell him the same thing, y'all going to have some problems, right? We try to baptize our wants as if they are the word of God all the time. And that's what we're going to work through a lot as we do these specific decision makings. If God actually said it, it is black and white, absolute, you cannot equivocate, no excuses matter. If God did not actually say it in his words, you better stop putting his name in the byline. Because you're just setting yourself up for trouble. If God decides that, actually, I didn't say that to you. You ate pizza way too late. You got some weird dreams, watching strange movies. I wasn't in on that one. Right? You did what you wanted to do. Any last questions here? And then next week we start diving into specific decisions. And what we're going to do to kind of warm up for the fighting and arguing and disagreement that will come later, is next week we'll start with decisions that churches make. How do we decide how to worship? So we'll just dive right into the worship wars, because that didn't get anybody excited. But how do churches determine how to worship faithfully? And what are the must-haves? And what are the lawful choices? And how we use wisdom in deciding which is better? And we're just going to work through that as a church, around a church decision, so that we're not stepping on any of anybody's individual toes yet. And then we'll save that for the rest of the semester. So,
succinctly, what would you say a person who made a decision that was lawful and within God's will and desire?
Yeah. Right.
And that person is continually second guessing that decision.
Yeah.
I know what I would say to that person, but what would you say to help that person?
My friend Steve May, who does a lot of men's ministry teaching, in his family they have an expression called FIDO, forget it and drive on. Decisions that you have made in the past that you do not have the ability to change at this point, you have to tear off the rearview mirror and throw it out. What does God want me to do now? What is the decision in front of me now? What are my options for faithfulness now? Is so much more valuable an exercise than what should I have done at a moment in history that I can no longer control. And when you're talking to that person, you have to be extremely sympathetic because, good grief, who doesn't do that? Who doesn't look back at some of their decisions and say, I wish I had done this differently? But the responsibility for us is to weigh out what's the knowledge that I need to glean from that for future decisions, and then what's the type of decision that I have to make now? And does that apply? Does that relate? Because you will live a more miserable existence than your circumstances dictate if you believe that those circumstances are God's punishment for the bad decision that you make that now you're going to have to live with forever. God doesn't call you to that. How important do you think you are? That you determine the course of history?
Even if it was a good decision.
Good decisions sometimes, right? Hey, I believe that God wants my family to be a missionary in XYZistan, raise money, get trained, go over to XYZistan, my family gets slaughtered. And yet, I have to trust God. That horrific event, which I will grieve about for the rest of my life in a human sense, was not because I made the wrong choice that brought me down to this alternate track. It was because that sequence of events is what brought God the most glory and was for their good, my family's good. Oh, it's hard to believe. God, help me believe it. Right? That's where we have to live.